বলছিলাম।
রাবলির গালে গাইলে না মুগুলা আসছিল,
হ্যাঁ তো হাজার 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 হাজার
Director of Information Management and Sector Coordination.
Director's Office, the Chief Director of Governance and Executive Support, the PLO in the Office of the Minister and in the Office of the Deputy Minister, Mr. Nicholas Leontinis, the Office of the Minister, Ms. Buisan Dibongo, and Biamkela Mbogoto. That is the team that is led by the Minister, by the Deputy Minister, and the DG. Can we then have apologies, Chilega, from your side?
Chair, Honorable Nkululu joins the meeting late. She's attending another program, but as soon as she's done outside, she will join us. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, we note the apology of Honorable Ntunu. Any other apologies, Honorable Members?
Chairperson, sorry, I'm not lifting my, putting my hand up. Can I'll have to leave at 5. I've got another virtual meeting starting at 5. Thank you.
Noted, Honorable Singh. Thanks. Any other apologies?
Chairperson, I also have another engagement, so I'll also be leaving soon.
Noted, Honorable Paulson. Thank you. Any other apologies? Okay. Can we then get the move of the adoption of the agenda?
Chair, it's Gancho. I move for the adoption of the agenda.
Thank you very much, Honorable Gancho. Can we get a seconder?
I'll second.
Chair, I second.
We'll take Honorable Winkler and Honorable Mbata to second us. Thank you very much. Deputy Minister, over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, and good afternoon to all Honorable Members. And let me also then extend my greetings to DG and the team from the department. Chairperson, I'm not going to waste your time. As per the agenda item, the DG and the team will lead us in this regard for both items. Maybe also I need to indicate that I'll be out in and out in the meeting, as I have indicated to the DG, because I have another meeting which has already started. It was a special meeting that was called while I have already confirmed for this meeting. But DG and the DDGs are here. I won't be long. I'm sure it will take less than 30 minutes. I will be in and out. Then, Chairperson, let me then, through yourself, give over to our DG then to take us through the two items as per your agenda of today. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, DM. DG?
Thank you very much, DM. Good afternoon, Chair. Good afternoon to the Honourable Members. The first presentation that we are going to make to the committee is on the briefing by the department on the state of fisheries report. I am with the DDG, Ms. Sue Middleton, and also with Dr. Kim Prochaska, who is going to be taking the committee through the detailed report. And the report focuses on the status of marine fisheries resource, what the status is, and also what is it that we are doing in relation to the fisheries resource, where there are challenges, Chair. With your permission, I'm going to request Dr. Kim Prochaska to then take the committee through the detailed report. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, DG. Good afternoon, Chair and Honourable Members. The presentation was sent through. Oh, there it is. Well done. Thank you to whoever is flighting the presentation. presentation. It's much appreciated. So this presentation is a presentation on the status of South Africa's marine fishery resources. It's a report that we update every second year, and this is the most recent update. We're still waiting for the hard copy report to be finalized, so you've got a sneak preview of this report today. In the presentation, I'm going to take you through first an overview of the status of marine fishery resources so we can get the big picture, and then we're going to focus down onto some key resources, and the ones we're going to take a look at in detail this afternoon are hake, the small pelagic fishes, which includes the sardine and anchovies, abalone, then west coast rock lobster, demersal sharks, and lionfish, and then we'll end with some concluding remarks. Next slide, please. All right, this picture gives us the overview of the big picture of the status of marine fishery resources. If you look on the left, it says fishing pressure, and that indicates the bottom blocks, in other words, the yellow and the green blocks, show where fishing pressure is light or optimal, and the top blocks, the red and the orange blocks, show where fishing pressure is heavy or too heavy. Along the bottom is stock status, and that indicates that the resources on the left, in the blocks on the left, so the red and the yellow blocks, that's where the stock status is poor. And the blocks on the right, the orange block and the green block, indicates where the stock status is good. So the worst, the place we don't want to be is the red block in the top left, where fishing pressure is high and the stock status is low. You can see there are a number of resources in that block. But contrary to that, if we then move to the bottom right, the green block is where the stock status is good and the fishing pressure is optimal. And I think it's very encouraging to see that there are a lot of resources in that block. The yellow block at the bottom left, that is where the stock status is poor, but the fishing pressure is low, and those are areas where we expect to see some recovery of those resources. In the orange block on the top right, that's where stock status is good, but fishing pressure is too high, and we need to do something to try and alleviate that fishing pressure to move those resources back into the green. We could have the next slide, please. All right, if we focus then, start focusing in, first looking at hake. The hake fishery captures both shallow water hake and deep water hake. It captures them together. It can't separate them. And the fish are caught in four different sectors. So there's the two hake trawl sectors, the inshore sector and the offshore sector. There's also a long line sector and a hand line sector. And then some hake are also caught as bycatch during midwater trawling operations for horse mackerel. The hake fishery is the biggest in South Africa, and the value of this fishery equals all of our other fisheries put together. If you look at the graphs, the one on the top right shows the captures of hake over the years, all the way back from 1917 onwards. The dark blue bars show the deep water hake, and the shallow, light blue bars show the shallow water hake. So you can see the fishery started originally targeting the shallow water hake because they didn't have such big boats to go out into the deep water. And then over time, as they got fancier and bigger boats, so they could access the deeper areas and then also catch the deep water hake. So you can see these days, most of the catch is made up by the deep water hake, and then not so much on the shallow water hake. The bottom diagram shows which sectors are catching that hake. So
So the dark blue bars are the Hake deep sea trawl sector. The yellow bits on top are the inshore trawl. The green bars show the longline fishery, and then the red bars show the handline fishery. If we go to the next slide, please. Thank you. So the Hake trawl fishery is the only South African fishery that is currently certified by the Marine Stewardship Council, which is an eco-labelling certification. And the fishery recently received its third recertification. This certification is important to the fishery because it gains it access to European markets, which it wouldn't otherwise have. And that access ensures that the industry gets a premium on the price of their product and ensures the economic viability of that industry. The certification carries with it various responsibilities, both for the client, which is the industry, and for us as the government management authority and the fisheries management branch. And these responsibilities include requiring to do regular surveys of abundance, which we do annual surveys of abundance, that we have reliable estimation of captures, and that we do. We continuously collect catch information and analyze that information from the fishery. We also require to do regular scientific assessment of resource status, and we do annual status assessments on the Hake resource. We're also required to have what are called harvest control rules or operational management procedures to determine annual catch limits. Essentially, this is a rule-based process. We're also required to have independent scientific observers, which is taken care of by the industry. There also needs to be adequate monitoring, control, and enforcement, which is conducted by our Chief Directorate of Monitoring, Control and Surveillance. And then there are also various measures to reduce the ecological impact of trawl fishing, such as damage to the seabed that might occur, or limiting the bycatch of sensitive species and various other measures to reduce ecological impact. Next slide, please. All right, so the most recent assessments of the Hake resource indicate a steady increase in the abundance of the shallow water Hake, but a slight recent decrease in the deep water Hake. It's not something that we're concerned about, though, because both species are estimated to lie well above what we call the maximum sustainable yield level. If you take a look at the diagram, the green line is the deep water Hake. You can see that's the abundance of the deep water Hake over time. The blue line is the shallow water Hake. And you can see the dotted line shows the maximum sustainable yield level. That's where one expects to get the most catch from one's fishery. And you can see that both resources are still well above that. The slight downturn in the end, the right-hand end of the green line for the deep water Hake, you will see now our current operational management procedure has responded to that by pulling the total allowable catch down by 5% for the current fishing season to compensate for that small dip. Thank you. Could we have the next slide, please? All right, moving on then to the small pelagic and fishes. So this is the sardines and anchovies. This is also one of our largest fisheries. The catches are mostly dominated by anchovy. If you look at the graph, the blue bars show the catches of anchovy. The green bars show the catches of sardines. And the orange shows the west coast round herring. So you can see the catch is mostly made up of anchovy. Sardine, you can also see, went through a peak in the early 1960s and then was low for many years after that, then went through another peak in the early 2000s and has tailed off again since then. catches currently of sardine are at a very low level. But if you look carefully on the right-hand side, you can see those little green bars seem to be increasing again. So we're keeping a close eye on what happens with the sardine resource. In total, 274,000 tons of anchovy, red eye, and sardine were caught in the 2022 season. And these captures were below the long-term averages, which is shown by the dotted and the brown lines on the diagram. Thank you. If we could move on. All right, if we look at the anchovy resource, the diagram shows the abundance, the biomass or abundance, which is the blue bars of anchovy over time. Don't worry about the line. That's the baby ones that are coming into the fishery for the next year. But you can see that the resource is variable to some extent. Those bars go up and down a bit, but at the moment things are looking fine there, just to indicate that there isn't a survey result for 2021 because we had a very curtailed survey and we don't trust the result too much, and we're still working on the result for the 2022 survey. Next slide, please. Thank you. This is now looking at sardine or pilchard. Again, if one goes straight to the graph, see the green bars indicate the biomass or the abundance of sardine. Again, the line indicates the babies that we expect to come into the fishery in the next year. So this is, as you can see, that peak in the early 2000s there, which is now in the middle of the graph. And you can see that since then, catches and biomass have remained fairly low. As I said, we're continuing to keep an eye on that. The resource remains of concern, and it requires continued precautionary management of that resource. Next slide, please. All right, coming closer to shore now, we're moving on to abalone. Abalone resource has suffered major declines in abundance over the years, despite the department's best efforts of management. Things that have been tried have include closure of the recreational fishery, major reductions in the total allowable catch that's allowed each year, closure of areas to fishing, and incorporation of an area management system. If you have a look at the graph that shows the catches of abalone over time, the green, dark green bars. The light green bars show the catches from the recreational subsistence and limited commercial fisheries when those were operating, but none of those operated for a very long time. So you can see that the catches were initially quite high in the sort of 1960s. They then leveled off till about the late 1990s, and then started to decline quite drastically. In response, the recreational fishery was closed in 2003. The commercial fishery was then closed in a desperate measure in 2008, but was opened again in 2010. And you can see catches remained extremely low since then. Next slide, please. All right, so the information that we have available do not indicate that there's been any recovery of the abalone resource to date. It is projected that the resource will continue to decline if the current levels of illegal harvesting continue. Looking at the graph, the blue bars show there the estimated amount of poached abalone. The line is essentially the same thing, it just reports on the number rather than by kilogram. and then the little red bars, which you have to look quite hard to see because they're right down at the bottom, show the commercial quota for abalone. So you can see that the major part of the catch of abalone is taken by the illegal fishery, and that catch is higher, it's far higher than the sustainable limits for this resource. Recovery of abalone may still be possible in some of the fishing areas, but only so long as there are major reductions in the illegal harvesting, because as I said, that number is far too high at this point. Could we have the next slide, please? All right, moving on to West Coast rock lobster. This is also quite a big fishery. It generates around 500 million per annum. It employs around 4,300 people. The fishery traditionally focused on the West Coast because that's where the resource was primarily located. But more recently, eastward shifts in the resource during the 1990s have resulted in three new areas being opened up to the east of Cape Country. The fishery consists of four sectors. There's the offshore commercial sector, which fishes with traps, the inshore commercial sector, which fishes with hoop nets, the interim relief and small-scale sectors, which also fish with hoop nets, and then the recreational fishery, which is either a diver or a hoop net fishery. Next slide, please. Thank you. So the catches of West Coast rock lobster have declined since the 1950s. There have been a number of reasons for this, including changing in fishing methods, stricter control of catches, declines in resource abundance, an increase in illegal harvesting, reduced growth rates, and environmental changes. At present, the resource is experiencing overfishing. If we look at the graph, the blue line shows the catch of West Coast rock lobster over the years, all the way from 1890 onwards. Again, you can see, although that's variable over the period from the 1950s onwards, you can see that blue line just goes down, continues to go down and down and down. Until we're now at a very low level. The resource is currently at only 1.3% of its pristine levels. Ordinarily, one would want a resource to be no lower than 20%, and preferably one would want it to be at around 40% to give one the maximum productivity of the resource. For interest, red line on the graph shows the growth. We've been monitoring growth since the late 1980s. And although that's also highly variable, you can see the line goes up and down a lot, the general trend is a decrease in growth rate. We don't fully understand that. It's linked somehow to environmental changes. If we could have the next slide, please. All right. Moving on to demersal sharks then. There are two main species involved here. They are soupfin sharks and smoothhound sharks. They are caught in multiple fisheries, including the directed demersal shark longline fishery, but they're also caught in the line fishery and in the inshore trawl fisheries. Looking at the diagrams, the top diagram shows soupfin shark, and similar to the diagram you saw at the beginning of the presentation, you have the green zone, which is the good zone, the red, which is the bad, then the orange and the yellow, which are somewhere in the middle, but for different reasons. If we look at the top diagram for soupfin shark, if you focus at the bottom right, there's a little white square. That's where the resource started off in 1952 in terms of its status. You then follow those dots and follow the line till we come to a white circle. That's where the resource status was in 1997. And then there's some more up and downing, and eventually you end up at a white triangle, which is where the resource was assessed as being in 2016. So you can see superfin shark is in the red zone. The stock status is low and the fishing pressure is too high. Moving in down to the bottom graph, which is smoothhound shark. Again, if you look at the bottom of the graph, you'll find the little white square. That's where the result started in, was that 1990, I think, when we first started tracking it. It then moved quite rapidly up into the orange zone by 2008, and then it's taken a few ups and downs to the white triangle for the 2016 assessment. So you can see, although the result status there is still good, we still think that the fishing pressure on that resource is a bit too high for sustainability. So further management measures are being put in place in order to attempt to improve the status of these resources. Next slide, please. All right, lionfish. I've got some good news for you here. The most recent stock assessments indicated that reductions of commercial fishing effort that were implemented from 2003 onwards have resulted in the partial recovery for some resources, notably the slinger, the sunter, and the carpenter, and you can see those sitting in the good green block down there. However, some other important stocks, such as silver carp, are still being overfished, and part of this is the cumulative impact of not only the line fishery, but also the inshore trawl fishery on the cob resource. The snook and yellowtail, which are things that are very important to us here in the Western Cape, those assessments suggest that the stocks are optimally exploited. Those two resources, the yellowtail and snook, are highly nomadic species, and they're very variable. We get really good bumper years when a lot of those fish are visiting our shores, and then poor years where they just don't come in close to our shores. But the assessments say that they are in good shape, both of those resources. Next slide, please. All right, for some severely depleted lionfish, however, and that includes resources such as red sternbass, duggerrod, and white stump nose, the current management measures that we have are insufficient, and those resources are continuing to decline. We have some difficulties with the slow translation of recommendations from the stock assessments into management regulations, and then illegal activities such as drone fishing further impact on overexploited species such as the silver cob. Next slide, please. All right, so to look then forward at the mitigation measures, things that the department is doing in order to mitigate against stock declines. We're engaging continuous monitoring of stock status, so we monitor the status of, I can't tell you exactly how many stocks, but the stocks that support 22 different fishing sectors. We monitor those annually. There's also continuous monitoring of captures from the fishery. There's adaptive management to ensure sustainable captures through annual adjustment of the total catch. So we set a total allowable catch or a quota each year. We also review the total allowable effort in those fisheries which are effort controlled. And then there are also other management measures which are reviewed annually and encapsulated in the permit conditions for each fishery sector. The department is also currently working on the West Coast Rock Lobster anti-poaching strategy. That doesn't mean that nothing's been done about poaching before. There's already been a lot of work in this regard. There's also the National Strategy and Action Plan to
prevent and combat the trade in illegally harvested South African abalone, which is being worked on at the moment. We have a national plan of action for sharks, which has been approved, and an implementation plan put together, and we are busy implementing that plan. There's a lionfish state of emergency and protocol, which has been in place since 2000 and are still in force and seems to be bearing some fruit, at least with some lionfish species. There's also implementation of the small-scale fishery and support to small-scale fishers, and the promotion of aquaculture and alternative livelihoods. We could have the last slide, please. In conclusion then, I think the main take-home messages are, firstly, that many of our resources are sustainably managed. It's not all doom and gloom out there. However, some resources, particularly near shore resources, which are fairly easily accessible, are overfished and subject to overfishing. The good news, however, is that interventions to reduce overfishing can lead to resource recovery, and we have some concrete examples from the deepwater hake, which was recovered very nicely, the south coast rock lobster, likewise, and some of the lionfish species. Thank you. That's what I have for you this afternoon. There are some acronyms. If I try not to use many. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, honourable members. Do we engage this report, or do we also take the report on working on fire, or working for program, honourable Brian?
Chair, I'm just cognizant of the fact that one or two of the colleagues have to leave, so I think they might not be able to make it to the end. So can I propose, if possible, that we take these questions now, and then we do the work on fire ones afterwards?
I second that motion, Chairperson.
Wonderful. Honourable Brian, you'll be the first then, followed by Honourable Winkler, followed by Honourable Singh, then followed by Honourable Paulson.
Thanks very much, Chairperson, and a big thank you for the presentation. It really was very enlightening, and it was great to see all of that detailed data and information, and I think one hopes perhaps we can get that on a more regular basis. I know that the presenter mentioned that those studies are conducted or intended to be conducted on an annual basis. At least on an annual basis, if we could get that report, that would be fantastic. Because I think it does clear up quite a number of questions, but perhaps also provides room for some new questions to be answered. So just the first one, one of the things that I noticed from the charts, and this is purely kind of out of interest, but perhaps it's a way of measuring trends going forward, is the spike in the populations of, I think it was anchovies and sardines around 2000 to 2006. What was the reason for that? If you can just expand on that. You also mentioned the decrease in the ongoing decrease in crayfish growth, and we saw that in that one chart as well, and it was mentioned that one of the reasons for this is environmental factors. Now, I do understand that crayfish is also obviously one of the most poached species, marine species. We did see quite a lot of info on the abalone poaching, but what are the environmental factors that are causing that decrease in crayfish growth? Could one attribute some of that at least to the poaching that's going on as well? Then in terms of the red stand wrasse and the duggerod,
good on you, Commissar.
Sorry.
Honorable Paulson?
Sorry, I think you turned it off. Is there anything that can be done aside from the
restrictions on cash to increase those populations, because in particular that dugout looks like it's on its way out. Is there anything else that can be done or that we can be advocating for, lobbying for, to try and assist in growing that population? And then the illegal abalone growth, I mean, that was quite a staggering chart to see the amount of abalone that's legally fished compared to the excessively high amount of illegally poached abalone. And even with all of the busts, and one does note and appreciate the busts that have been taking place recently, there seem to have been quite a few of them, it still just doesn't seem to be making any kind of a difference whatsoever. Is the majority of that abalone still going to China? Where is it going to, if not so? And if it is still going to China, maybe the Deputy Minister can answer this, are steps being taken to put increased pressure on the Chinese government to assist in combating the smuggling of that abalone into their country? Thank you.
Honourable Winkler.
Thank you, Chair. So my first question is with regard to the different shark species. So my understanding is that there is a limit of one species of shark that are obviously allowed to be caught per day, for example, by a recreational fisher, and then they've got a bag limit of about 10. Has there been a study that looks at how many recreational fishing permits we actually have issued and how that impacts on, I think, shark population sizes in South Africa? And, you know, not only on the threatened species, for example, like the soupfin shark and the great white. And then the other issue was, in terms of compliance and total allowable catches and compliance with the regulations around the fishing industry, what is the status of monitoring and enforcement? I do know from some of my own research that seems to be a bit of an issue because of, I think, a strain on resources in the department. Yes, and then with regards to the abalone poaching, is there any map or way forward on how to mitigate against increased stats in abalone poaching? What more can be done? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Winkler. Honourable C.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good afternoon, colleagues, and DM and everybody else online. Well, thank you for this presentation, which is not only useful, but is also colorful. When you print it in color, it looks quite nice when you see the lobsters and everything else. What I'd like to know is, you know, as a young boy growing up in KwaZulu-Natal, I've always heard about shad fishing and realized many, many years that shad and elk are the same species. And there is a closed season for shad, I think from October, November each year. I'd just like to know whether there have been recent studies to confirm the effectiveness of this ban. What has it produced? I know October, November is known as the spawning season, but have there been studies, you know, because a number of fishermen, line fishermen, rely on shad, and there is also a restriction of 4 per day, and I know the authorities in KwaZulu-Natal can be quite difficult in applying the law, which I don't have a problem with, but people have been thrown into prison for catching 5, 6, and 7 shad. So if we can just have some information on elf shad. But the interesting thing is, when I was in Cape Town many years ago when I first started Parliament, people used to sell elf in Cape Town, but when you come to Durban, it was the same shad. You couldn't buy it here because it was banned. So just just some thought on that. Secondly, I think this question has been asked, but I just want to emphasize, when looking at the orange and red sections, and we see particularly on slide 13 and 14 with prawns and sharks, now, what kind of restrictions are placed on the inshore trawlers? That's one. Secondly, what is the level of poaching that we have been able to identify as the monitoring authority, poaching of these kinds of species? Because, you know, I was told some time ago that off the coast in another country, our neighbors up north, you know, people used to poach and send trawlers there and just continue poaching. And some of these fish where we imposed bans on are fish which the line fishermen used to be catching. But here are trawlers out at sea taking away tons of fish that they are not supposed to catch in those quantities, and they are not even supposed to be in our waters to do that. The last question would be, I think you've said many times, we are required to have, and then you continue, we are required to have A, B, C, D. We are required to have. My question will be, do we have? Do we have the capacity to monitor all these regulations and kind of restrictions that we impose? What is lacking in terms of having capacity there? It's good for us to have regulations on catch sizes, on species, etc. But are we equipped to actually observe what is happening out there, both inshore and onshore? So that will be my last question, because that deals with the remedial action on slide 17. Thank you.
Honorable Paulson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for listening. If you don't mind, I'm going to leave my camera off. Chairperson, having grown up along the coast, and especially in Cape Town, fishing for most of the people of the Western Cape, it's a way of life. It's more than just a livelihood. But currently, it's become a source of desperation, because the people who used to fish, the indigenous fishers, have been denied access to the sea. And the people, and they are not the ones, they have been denied access because of dwindling fishing stocks. And the irony is, they are not the ones responsible for dwindling fishing stocks. There's no way any number of poachers could take our fishing stock levels to the levels it is at the moment. This is caused by big commercial fishing companies. And we've seen now again, Chairperson, with the fishing rights allocation process, it was those big commercial fishing companies that were favored, that there is a move for them to have a greater share of what remains of our fishing stocks. Very little is going to go to small-scale fishers. In fact, the way small-scale fishing will be managed through these co-ops, it's almost going to be unworkable situation. So given the dire state of abalone and rock lobster stocks, why are these species still being allocated to big commercial, who mercilessly harvest these stocks from the ocean? That's my first question. Now, I know we like to say abalone goes to China. Abalone that is being, as you say, poached, you know, it's not people poaching, it's people wanting to survive. And China's providing them with a survival. Whereas if we took abalone and
south coast rock lobster away from big commercial fishers and gave it to the small-scale fishers or the indigenous fishers, there'd be no poaching. They'll be able to supply the market. They'll be able to support their families. But I know these are just, well, this ANC government doesn't, this government doesn't care about poor black people. We'd be able to reduce poaching. And poachers are being criminalized for wanting to eke out a living for themselves and take care of their families. But so we like to blame it on the Chinese, but what China is doing is investing more in, and China doesn't have, like, you know, these 15-year jackpots that we have in fisheries, because we know only, we know who's going to win those jackpots. It doesn't matter how bad Oceania is, they're going to be rewarded with a jackpot allocation. It's just how it is. As corrupt as Oceania is, this government will still reward them with more. The Chinese are investing in more in aquaculture. So China, every 5 years, they assess the situation and the growth of the aquaculture, and they gradually reduce the amount of fish being allowed to be caught in the open seas. So they are increasing the amount of fish being contributed by aquaculture. And this is where we are lagging behind when it comes to aquaculture. We know that this department sends people to some university, but never, they said they do send to the Chinese. I doubt it very much, because the Chinese has the most advanced aquaculture industry, highly effective, producing more than 50% of the world's aquaculture produce. So this is one way of reducing the strain on our oceans, is developing our aquaculture industry and reducing the strain on our oceans and forcing these fishing companies actually to invest money elsewhere. They are the ones that are responsible for destroying our oceans. So why aren't we not compelling them to the aquaculture industry? And also, we haven't been apprised of the role that our fishing hatcheries should be playing in increasing our fishing stocks. So it would be interesting to know how much is the department investing in these hatcheries to ensure that we also play our part in increasing fishing stocks instead of limiting indigenous fishers and allowing commercial fishing companies, white monopoly capital, to plunder our oceans for profits. And we all have to pay the price, and especially the indigenous recreational fishing. So I'd like to know the state of our aquaculture industry, and also what's the state of our hatcheries. Maybe, Chairperson, we should go and conduct oversight to these hatcheries and to these aquaculture projects so that we can see they really exist. Because the department will come here and tell us nice stories, but a few years ago we went to two aquaculture projects in the Eastern Cape. It was nothing but big ditches in the ground with lots of money spent and absolutely no aquaculture activity at all. So we must be able to go and see with the naked eye that these things exist, and that, you know, that we're not just hearing nice fairy tales in these committees. Thank you very much.
Hello, Chair, to Honorable Paulson, Honorable Weber, followed by Honorable Ganjo. Thank you, Chair. I really appreciate this. Chair, I only have four questions. The first one is I just want to link on to what Honourable Singh said. If you look at the left red block, you were looking at fishing pressure is really high and the stock is a problem. So my question is, what is the management process that you have in place to reduce or to ensure that, you know, for instance, there's two tuna that is in that block, and it concerns me because tuna is probably one of the most sick of the fish. People eat it in tins, and it is a very healthy and everything. So what do we do to ensure that it doesn't become less? Is there a place where you grow them and before you put them back in the sea or anything like that? What is your management process to ensure that the fish doesn't reduce? I know Honourable Singh referred to poaching. I exclude poaching. What is the plan to ensure that we will always have tuna, especially with the extreme high demand that there is? And if there is such a management process, if you can maybe just give that to us. And then, and with that, how do we ensure that it increases if we don't stop the fishing of the tuna so that they can come back to the level where they should be? I refer now to tuna, it's probably all of them in the red block. My second question is that in previously in 2017, the Fishery Climate Change Task Team has recommended 7 points. And I want to know not only how many have been completed, but how far we are. Are we busy in completing them? And if not, why not? And if you can maybe give us a list of how far you are and when the due dates will be there. And then, has there been a tender process for a fishery observer program? I think Honourable Singh also referred to that. It is essential that we have to have such a program. Is there such a plan? Has there been a tender out of it? Is there a plan to have such a program? And if not, why not? Because it is, I think, one of our most essential programs that we have to have. And then, maybe have a list of all the freshwater aquaculture, not only at our coastal cities, but I know in Mpumalanga there is quite a lot. I know in Free State there is a lot of aquaculture, and what exactly it is that they are farming. If we can have a list of that, and then to, in order also to do oversight to ensure that we, as Honourable Paulson said, that we don't get to a place where there seems to be activities, the money goes into it, but there's actually nothing. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Gajo.
Thank you, Chair. And let me also appreciate the report. Chair, I only have one question. I'm not going to repeat other questions that have already been covered by our colleagues. Chair, I just want to check with the department if they can tell us their most effective interventions for reducing overfishing and promoting resource recovery in South African fisheries. And also if they can tell us how can this intervention be scaled up to address broader sustainability challenges. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Banjo. Just from my side, before we get responses, Ms. Prashanta, what is the accuracy of the fisheries stock surveys insofar as the marine living resources are concerned? How confident are you about the poaching, as the Honourable, I think Honourable Paulson and Honourable Singh especially by foreign vessels. Have you ever encountered such instances? Or if you have not, are we sure that it is not taking place? Are you able to assure South Africans that what is happening in the rhino population is not happening in South African waters? To what extent can you assure us, or what are the proof areas that you are able to give us guarantees that what is happening in that population of rhinos could not be taking place in the oceans of our country? Thank you. Ms. Prozaska?
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you, honourable members, for the questions. I will answer the questions that I'm able to answer, but my DDG, Ms. Middleton, can also please come in and assist on some of the questions around the compliance and enforcement, the questions around allocations, and some of the questions around aquaculture. Honourable Bryant requested to know about the spikes in the sardine and anchovy, what the reasons for those were. And these are just natural fluctuations in those populations. These small pelagic fish, they are very short-lived, and you know their populations are highly variable. So it looks, if you looked at that slide, I can't remember which one it was, slide 7, which showed the time series going back from 1949, you could see the anchovy was just up and down all over the place, but the sardine looked like it had two very significant peaks. And we've tried to look at those peaks and correlate them with environmental variables, but without any success. So most environmental processes like El Ninos, etc., those happen on much shorter timescales. You see those peaks are about 40 years apart, and we've not found any way of necessarily explaining those from an environmental perspective. The West Coast rock lobster growth that we've attributed to environmental factors, again, my apologies, it is very difficult to try and find correlations between a process like growth in rock lobster and what's going on in the environment. And we've looked at lots of factors but not found anything that really correlates in a way that we would have any confidence in. Some of the explanation that's been provided in the past is that as the resource gets less, remember rock lobsters have a minimum size limit, so they're caught and then they're sorted on board the vessel, and then the ones that are too small are thrown back in the sea. Now, in that sorting process, they essentially go through a grid, and they get quite a bit of damage. The legs fall off, and feelers get broken off, etc. Then, when those animals go back in the water, they have to regrow those limbs. So they put energy into regrowing those limbs rather than growing in size. And as the population gets smaller and smaller, so you're fishing a greater and greater proportion of the population, a larger proportion of animals of going through the sorting grid and then having to deal with that kind of damage. So that, you know, that's an explanation, but there's no way of testing whether that explanation is indeed the correct one. So we look at the growth, and we do have growth estimates every year, and those go into the stock assessment for West Coast rock lobster. In terms of red stern, rust, and sugarrod, what can be done? I mean, there are a number of management measures that there are already a lot of management measures in place on these species, and there are others. there are quite a lot of tools in the box. The difficulty that we experience here is that to change the regulations around lion fish requires a full SAAS process, which is extremely time consuming. So it's very difficult for us to react and to put these measures in place. The illegal abalone, I think mostly I'm going to leave that to Sue Middleton to respond to. But just to say, you said that the busts are not making a difference, and I can only agree, because from the perspective of the abalone resource, what's important is that the resource stays in the water. Catching loads of abalone that have already been removed from the water doesn't help the resource in any way. Honourable Winkler asked about recreational fishing permits and the impact of recreational fishing. Yes, we know how many permits are sold by the post office each year. We have that information. In terms of the impact, that is a bit difficult for us to gauge directly. At the moment, our information from the recreational lion fisheries is quite limited, because it's a very, as you know, there are a lot of people out there engaging in recreational lion fishing, and they're spread over a huge amount of coastline. So to try and monitor closely what those people are catching is difficult. So to gauge the impact accurately is very hard. We usually rely then on kind of once-off surveys that are done every few years in order to try and gauge that impact. Then the other two questions were around compliance and abalone, how to mitigate against abalone poaching, and again, I'm going to leave those for Sue Middleton to answer. The shad first season, look, it's not something that I have such in-depth knowledge about, and I tried to find something on my computer while you were asking, but I couldn't in the short space of time. So I don't have a detailed response on the shad closed season. In terms of the orange and red and the inshore trawl, yes, the inshore trawl does catch a number of bycatch species, including lionfish species. We have estimated what they catch, because of course we get that information from the fishery. So we do know what the impact of that is. We have also a program with the inshore trawl fishery in order to try and reduce or limit that bycatch to certain levels. And then if they catch too many of those, they have to move and start fishing somewhere else, etc. So there are some precautions in place there. Honourable Paulson also asked about poaching and big commercial companies. Why are abalone rock lobsters still allocated to commercial sectors and then aquaculture? So I'm going to refer those questions to my DDG. Honourable Weber, you asked about the management process, particularly for tuna. So tuna are a strange one, because we don't, those resources are managed by what are called regional fisheries management agencies. There are three that, as South Africa, we participate in. There's the Indian Ocean Tuna Commission, the International Commission for the Conservation of Atlantic Tuna, so that takes care of both sides of our country, and then the Commission for the Conservation of Southern Bluefin Tuna. And we participate in all of those. And those are the forums where the assessments are done, because they do regional-based assessments. They take the information from all of the countries in those regions. They do regional-based assessments, and then there is regional allocation. So it's not a process that South Africa does itself, but we input our information. We have scientists in those groups, and we participate in those commissions to make sure that South Africa gets its fair share. You also asked about stopping fishing to allow recovery, and yes, that, you know, that is one way of doing it. Usually we prefer not to close the fishery. So you're going to get the fastest recovery of the resource if you close the fishery entirely. But because fisheries are economic activities, that's not the preferred way to go. So usually there's a trade-off between taking lower levels of recovery over a longer time, but still keeping that economic activity open, so keeping the fishery open. We try our very best not to close fisheries, because it has far too much impact, economic impact. In terms of observer programs, yes, you're correct. The observer program came to an end, and we're never able to reinstate it again as a single program, just because of the budgetary requirements. It's very expensive to have a lot of scientific observers out there in the field all the time. We are rethinking now how to restart observer programs. So in some fisheries, there's already a user pays observer program. For example, the Hake deep sea trawl is doing that in order to meet its Marine Stewardship Council requirements. The horse mackerel midwater trawl fishery, we require that fishery also to pay for observers on their vessel for 100% of their fishing operations. So we're looking at different models of how we can reintroduce observer programs to the different sectors. It doesn't have to be a one-size-fits-all kind of a solution. So we need to look at what works best in the different sectors. And then, Honourable Weaver, I'm afraid I didn't understand your climate. I'm kind of missed your question on climate change, so I can't respond to that. And I will let Sue respond on the list of aquaculture projects that you requested. Honourable Ganshaw, you asked about the most effective interventions for recovery and how these can be scaled up. Recall that we can, you know, you're going to get the strongest recovery of a resource if you stop all harvesting of that resource, but that's not what we want to do. So we do need to be pragmatic, and we need to have more nuanced, you know, discussions about where we want, how we want different resources to cover, over what time period, to what level, etc. And it's very dependent on each resource, because they all respond differently. And thank you. And then, Chair, how confident are we in our assessments? Again, it's hard to give a single answer, because it varies. So there are some resources for which we have a lot of information, and then we have really strong assessments that we know we can really rely on. Well, for other resources, we have less information, and so for those, we have assessments, but we have perhaps less confidence in those assessments. When it comes to the estimates of poaching, and that's always difficult because it's an illegal activity. So getting information on that activity and the impact of that activity is really hard. So looking at West Coast rock lobster, for example, our estimates of poaching currently are that it's somewhere between 200 and 800 tons a year. That's quite a broad range. We can't really pin that down any further with the information that's available to us at the moment. For abalone, we think we've got it a bit more refined than that. We've been doing it longer for abalone, monitoring the poaching, and we use both information from our compliance chief directorate on confiscated abalone, and then information from an NGO called Traffic on discrepancies between exports of abalone from South Africa and imports into receiving countries. So we've got more than one source of information there that helps us get a bit more confidence on where we are with the abalone poaching estimates. Thank you, Chair, unless there's any follow-up, I think that's responded to the questions.
Honourable members, can I check if the... Oh, Sue, I see you don't mind.
Yes. Thank you, Chair. If I could, with your permission, pick up a few of the non-scientific questions that were directed to us, and also the one question that was directed to DM regarding have we engaged with China. So let me start off by confirming, Honourable Bryant, that you are correct that China and Hong Kong and the Far East in general are the main buyers of the illegal both West Coast rock lobster and abalone fishery. And we have had previous attempts to engage with our Chinese colleagues, particularly through BRICS, but I think that this is an initiative and an effort that needs more focus. As you may be aware, we've just recently, at the end of February, conducted a very successful abalone anti-poaching week-long workshop where we brought together all the role players, from including the poachers, community, commercial, small-scale, government, NGOs, CBOs, you name it. We try to get all stakeholders that are involved in the abalone fishery together and to develop an integrated strategy that deals not just with enforcement and compliance efforts, but looks at co-management, that looks at international issues, including trying to understand the international value chain. And there, I must just say to Honourable Paulson that the poaching of abalone in particular, and increasingly this is the case with West Coast rock lobster, it's syndicated crime. And that the community-based poachers are the bottom of that value, of that illicit value chain, and they are not seeing the profits of the illicit trade, and nor are the average South Africans, because there's no tax being paid on those exports. So the we are about, in this next week, we'll be releasing the strategy that was developed for comment by the stakeholders who were at the workshop, and then we will be releasing it to the public. But we're hoping that this strategy will be an attempt not just to focus on the poachers, but to really develop an integrated approach to dealing with the problem in its entirety. Honourable Winkler, you also asked about the status of our compliance and to what extent are we able to enforce adherence to TAC, TAE and other permit conditions. And obviously, we do have our own compliance capacity in-house through our fishery control inspectors. But obviously, we do not have enough human resources, and on average, our inspectors are covering far too much coastline in order to be effective. So Obviously, the one answer would be to increase the capacity, but as we know, government doesn't have additional funds, and that is why we are have developed an integrated enforcement strategy through Operation Pakisa, where we work with other law enforcement agencies, because we will not be able to deal with the issue of enforcement and illegal trade on our own. We are also in the process, and I think it will come out in the next presentation, on the working force. We have appointed a number of, or are in the process of appointing a number of catch data monitors through the Working for Fisheries program. And these will be officials who will be deployed along the coastline at all the harbors and landing sites. And here the focus is to focus on accurate recording of the fish that is landed and to eliminate possible underreporting on fishing, on fish catches. And this is a program that was in place a couple of years ago, but that fell by the wayside, and we've restarted it. And we think this will go a long way in contributing to the enforcement and compliance strategy and the recording, accurate recording of catch, the fish that is actually landed. Honourable Paulson, I think in the previous meeting where we presented on aquaculture, the issue of sending students to Stirling University in Scotland was addressed, and my colleague Mr. Somoli I think very articulately stated that the reason why we send graduates, postgraduates to Stirling is because they have the best fish doctor or veterinary postgraduate course in the world. But we do have agreements with China, and in particular, their strength is around production systems. And we have a number of joint ventures with China and the Chinese, and in fact, the Chinese were a partner in our Kharif Aquaculture Demonstration and Training Center. And members are welcome. If you want to do an oversight visit, I would suggest you do pay a visit to the Kharif Training Center. The Honourable Weber, like my Dr. Prochaska, I also didn't understand the question, or I missed it, on the climate change and the 7 points. I'm personally not familiar with what document or study you're referring to. So if you are able to elaborate, we will try and answer that question. Again, Honourable Weber, we're not able to provide you with a list here and now of all the freshwater aquaculture species, where and where they are farmed, but we will gladly submit that information to you in writing. Similarly, Honourable Singh, we will submit in writing the answer to your question about the CHAD, the shad closed season, particularly in KZN. Chairperson, you asked about poaching of foreign vessels. Foreign vessels are not allowed to fish in South African waters at all. It's 100% only South African flag vessels can fish in our EEZ. And we're pretty confident that there's very limited foreign fishing happening in our waters, or poaching by foreign vessels. We are able to track all vessels that enter into our waters, and we're able to monitor the speed at which they are traveling, whether they've got nets deployed, and whether they're fishing or not fishing. And all vessels, it's not illegal for foreign vessels to pass through our waters. It's called safe passage. They have to have our permission to do so, because obviously you've got to get from Mozambique to Namibia if you want, and you've got to pass through our waters. We allow that, but we monitor them in and out of our waters. So I'm not saying that there is no illegal fishing happening by foreign vessels, but we're pretty confident that if it is, it's very on a very small scale. And yes, there was a question about abalone ranching, or the seeding of putting fish back into the water. And we had, this was one of the issues and focus areas that came up in the abalone workshop. And it is something that we're going to be taking forward. There's quite a big successful abalone ranching project in the Eastern Cape. And we want to roll that out and to look at other areas in which abalone, small abalone are put back into our waters. Honourable Forson also asked about fingerlings and hatcheries, and this is something that is happening through our aquaculture component, and there are successful hatchery and fingerling growing farms. Honourable Chair, well, I think hopefully we've covered everything, so back to you.
Honourable Webber, would you please try to clarify that question?
Yes, on slide 132, page 132 of the report that they are presenting on, I just don't have it in front of me right now. The team that was busy with it is composed of four scientists from the Chief Directorate of Fisheries Research and Development, Jean, I can't pronounce that name, Gethaiga, Cole van der Lingen, Steve Lambert, and David Yamane. But, maybe I must just put that question into writing so we can get a full-on answer, because it's quite a loaded question, if you can put it like that. It's quite comprehensive.
Honourable Singh, are you comfortable in getting your responses in writing?
Yes, thank you very much, Chair.
Wonderful. All right. I suspect that brings us to the end of the report on the state of fisheries. So if you could just also include, if you have a link with the is it the Navy or the South African Police Service, whoever is responsible for the vessels there, as it relates to that question of your confidence about the foreign vessels fishing in our seas, because we are told it is completely illegal. But what are the tools that you are applying, that you are using to ensure that there isn't? Because if you say that if it's happening, it could be at a very low scale, I think that also is also illegal. But just tell us about your links with whoever is responsible to ensure that there aren't any fishing by foreign vessels. Perhaps please include that in your response in writing. Are we fine with that, Ms. Middleton?
Yes, Chair. Can do that.
Great. Can then get a briefing, DG, by the Department on the Working for Programs?
Thank you, Chair. We do have the report, and Dr. Mkiza is going to cover the whole presentation on all the Working for Programs. We also do have then the various managers from fisheries, forestry, and also environmental programs, who then can be in a position position to elaborate on some of the issues which then the committee would want to seek clarity on. With your permission, Chair, can I request Dr. Mkize to take the committee through? Thank you.
Dr. Mkize?
Thank you, DG. Good afternoon, DM. Good afternoon, Chair, and honorable members and colleagues. I will be taking you through the Working For program presentation. I will just use my video just for a moment and then proceed with your permission with the video off. The presentation that we are giving to the Portfolio Committee this afternoon, as the DG has indicated, covers three branches: the Environmental Programs branch, the Forestry branch, and also then the Fisheries branch. Next slide, please. And in terms of the presentation, we will just highlight to the committee the purpose of each Working For program, but with an understanding that this is not necessarily the first time we are making the presentation to the committee, and as such, part of the presentation will then reflect on cumulative performance, that is performance from quarter one to quarter three, and then also expenditure and also the allocations for the next financial year. We will then look into updating the committee in terms of the progress that we are making on addressing the challenges in terms of the solutions that we had.
You got cut.
Let me just check on her chaperson.
I apologize for that. I was cut off. I was offline for a moment. So may we please move on to the next slide, or may I be given controls? Thank you. In terms of the overview, as we had presented earlier, I think it was in December 2021, we had given an overview in terms of the different Working For programs within the Environmental Programs branch. And also, just for me to highlight that even though it's three branches that are presenting to the committee today, what is common across the branches is that the three branches, when it comes to the Working For programs, we use the approach of the Expanded Public Works program. And as such, with each program, we then track the number of work opportunities that are created, the full-time equivalent per program. We also, particularly within the environmental programs aspect, track the number of people that are declared competent from having participated in accredited training programs. And then for each Working For programs, there are environmental outputs that we track in terms of performance, with an understanding that with EPWP, we basically use the principles and the guidelines of EPWP to deliver services or do work that the department is mandated to do in any case. So that's why with each program, we measure the environmental outputs. Next slide, please. So within the environmental programs portfolio, next slide, we have a list of programs, and the most known one is the Working For Water program, whose focus is mainly on the management and control of invasive alien species. We would appreciate that with the Working For Water program, even though we say alien species, the focus has been mainly on invasive alien plants due to their implications or the impacts that they cause in terms of our precious water resources, and also just in terms of their contribution when it comes to even putting risk in terms of our food security when they take over lands that are meant for agricultural purposes. We also have the Working For Wetlands program that focuses on the restoration and rehabilitation of wetlands to enable wetlands to continue to provide their ecosystem services. We have the Working On Fire program, whose focus, and we work closely with the forestry branch in this one, in terms of minimizing the impact of wildfires. So the focus integrated wildland fire management. We are working for ecosystems that focuses in terms of us achieving an intact ecological infrastructure and goods and services in that regard. Next slide, please. The branch continues to work with other branches in terms of implementing programs within the EPWP portfolio. So we use the Expanded Purple Box program principles and guidelines as indicated earlier. And with our biodiversity and conservation branch, we have the People and Parks program, where the focus is for us to provide a fair and equitable sharing of benefits from biological resources. And also within the biodiversity economy program, we focus on working with the biodiversity and conservation branch in terms of ensuring fair access and equitable sharing of benefits that relate to bioprospecting, particularly within the context of indigenous biological resources. We are working for land that also focuses on restoration and rehabilitation of land, and also then greening and open space management, which focuses on development of environmentally friendly recreational paths that lead to green corridor development. Next slide, please. With the chemicals and waste management branch, we have the working on waste program. And there we focus on a range of expanded public works program projects that focus on creating livelihoods through recycling of waste and also cleaning and greening, particularly cleaning of cities and towns. And I will talk to a partnership that we are having with the local government in terms of municipal cleaning and greening. With the oceans and coasts branch, working for the coast, and also across the branches, we also have a portfolio that we call Youth Empowerment and Development. In this portfolio, we focus in line with the mandates of the different branches, training, accredited training, and also development opportunities for our youth. Next slide, please. Just for me to then indicate that from the start of the financial year up until the end of quarter three, so quarter one to quarter three, this slide is intended to show the cumulative performance. So it's performance from quarter one to quarter three of the current financial year. So by the end of quarter three, we had achieved only 54% of our full-time equivalents. We had created 34,242 opportunities. That works out to 60% of our targets by quarter three. And also, in terms of the number of participants who had completed accredited training programs as part of our youth development portfolio, we had overachieved in that regard from quarter one to quarter three. And then also in terms of the number of percent by the end of quarter three, on the number of wetlands and rehabilitation, the branch was had exceeded the performance range when we look at performance from quarter one to quarter three against targets up to quarter three. On the number of kilometers of accessible coastline cleaned, we had achieved 91% of the target, but now noting that we are in quarter four, there are areas where there is improvement in terms of us being able to achieve the quarter and also the annual targets. On the number of biodiversity infrastructure units constructed or innovated, the target was met in terms of quarter one to quarter three. The cumulative performance indicates that we were at 100%, similarly with the overnight and visitor staff accommodation, wherein by the end of quarter three, we're at 100% in terms of performance. I do have to highlight that in terms of the demographic targeting, we acknowledge that across the environmental programs, although we had exceeded the youth allocation in terms of having been able to, quarter three, perform at 65% youth and also achieved the percentage for people living with disabilities. But when it came to women, we were still at 51%, and we are, in terms of the measures that we introduced for quarter four, looking at us meeting the target. Next slide, please. So in terms of the 2023-2024 financial year, it's us to just highlight that in terms of the expenditure by quarter three, the branch was at had spent 2.175 billion in terms of its annual allocation, And also for the next financial year, we are allocated a budget of 3,271,683,000. I would like to highlight that in the course of the 2022-23 financial year, the department and particularly the branch has undergone through a reorganization of the structure. And the intention of the reorganization of the structure was for us as a branch to revisit and also address inefficiencies that came with how we were structured, how we were executing or approaching project and contract management. And as such, the allocation for 23-24 reflects that now, instead of having a natural resources management or environmental protection and infrastructure programs, EP has been reorganized to three different regions, Region 1, Region 2, and Region 3, and also in terms of sector coordination and quality management, as well as the Office of the DDG. It is just for us to highlight that with the changes that have been made in terms of the reorganization of the structure, it then means that EP at a provincial level is then able to engage with its stakeholders better, but also enables the department to be able to assess and track performance, because now we're going to have a director. Each director is going to be responsible for a province, unlike before or previous engagement, where in one province, one could have a natural resources management director and an EPIP director, or environmental protection and infrastructure program director, each working in a similar province. So we are hopeful that with the organization that we have received approval for, and we are implementing, that the performance also in terms of the issues that we have received, it will be better. Next slide, please. This slide then talks to the targets for the 2023-24 financial year. And as such, I mean, it's just highlighting that the number of work opportunities and the number of full-time equivalents for EP, we take the greater share when it's compared to our forestry and also the fisheries branch. And here we highlight that the contribution of EP programs and also forestry. We then limit it to environmental outputs that are related and restricted to the environmental programs branch in terms of the targets for initial and follow-up clearing of invasive alien species, as well as wetlands and also the wildlife, percentage of wildfires suppressed, and also the two biodiversity infrastructure targets being 23 and 21 for the next financial year. Next slide, please. That was the end in terms of EP, just in terms of performance and also the overview. So on Working for Forestry, this is a program that is implemented by our forestry branch, and its main focus is improving the management of woody biomass resources so that we reduce the risks associated with invasions, biodiversity losses, and also just improving the socioeconomic benefits through this particular program. What is highlighted in this slide also is that for the 2022-2023 financial year, the cumulative performance was that by quarter three, we had targeted to have created 559, and it actually achieved 429. And when it comes to work opportunities, there's an excess and overachievement in terms of us having achieved by almost 300 in terms of the targeted 1,118, but the actual performance was 1,419, so that then equates to 127%. And in terms of when one looks at the program Working for Forests on its own, I mean, it demonstrated that they had achieved the youth target, but also exceeded the targets, both targets in terms of the youth participants and also the women are exceeded as far as the 63 and the 65.3 are concerned. Next slide, please. Next slide, sir. Okay, may I please continue with the presentation? While the presenter catches up in terms of where we are with the slide.
Who is moving the slide?
It's Yamkela.
Okay. to the next slide, Yamkela. There we are, Mem Chize.
Thank you. It has not moved from my side. Yamkela, can you please move on to the next slide?
Which page are you in?
On this presentation that is projected, we are on slide 12.
Yamkela is already at page 15.
Okay, maybe
do you want to share my screen?
That is yes, if that is possible, may I share from my screen, please?
Please, can you intervene there?
Apologies, Chair. I'm not able to share the screen. It says host disabled. Attendee screen sharing.
Yeah, you have been assigned. Now you can share.
Thank you. Is it visible?
Not yet.
Is it not yet visible?
Not yet.
Let me try again. Share screen. Okay. Visible now?
Yes, you are at slide 15 now.
Yes, thank you. So, apologies for that. On Working for Forest, the slide basically communicates the baseline in terms of the outputs and also the targets when it comes to the EPWP focus areas of work opportunities targeted, the full-time equivalent. But also on environmental outputs, it's the number of hectares of temporary unblended areas planted, which is 1,800 for the 23-24 financial year. The number of hectares in state forests that will be rehabilitated, and the rehabilitation includes clearing of invasive alien weeds, which is 200 hectares, and then also the number of trees outside state forests planted, as part of the greening, which is 120,000. The next program that I'm going to present is the Working for Fisheries. I think my colleague Utitiji Middleton had already started indicating that when this presentation comes through, then we'll share the focus areas and the aspects that relate to some of the questions that were raised. For this presentation, Working for Fisheries, it is just important to highlight that for the 23-24 financial year, there's an allocation of 102,552,000. And also the manner in which the Working for Fisheries program is structured. It is structured such that it aligns and is informed by the focus areas of the fisheries branch itself. So those areas talk to aquaculture and economic development. And for example, we have Hembeck community aquaculture, the Harib, and also the Hout Bay abalone farming projects. It talks to monitoring, control, and surveillance activities that align with marine anti-poaching. It talks to marine resource management, which is small-scale fisheries, particularly on mentorship, and then also the research and development, which talks to cage data capturing. In terms of the Working for Fisheries program, by the end of the quarter, which is quarter three, from quarter one to quarter three, the performance on work opportunities target against the target of 100 for the APP, the branch had achieved from quarter one to quarter three, they had achieved 255 work opportunities. But there is an intention that there will be the annual target will be exceeded because the projected performance on work opportunities by the end of quarter four is 750. In terms of full time equivalent, it's slightly under in terms of 228. And by quarter three, we were when it comes to the performance against the demographic targeting,
hold on, Mrs. Bridget. Please be kind to mic. Proceed, Ma'am Keaton.
Thank you, Chair.
Sorry about that.
On women, the branch was at 57% on youth, 61% against a target of 55%, and also on people living with disabilities were 2. I mean, the target was basically met. In terms of the forecast for working for fisheries on the 23-24 financial year, the interest or the focus is on creating 1,500 work opportunities with 750 full-time equivalents, and also making sure that, I mean, from 23-24, the duration of employment is targeted at 24 months, in line with the demographic targeting in terms of women, youth, and people living with disabilities. The other part of the slide...
We cannot hear you.
You cannot? Am I not audible now?
I can hear.
Chair, am I not audible?
You are audible now, please.
Thank you, and apologies for that. What this slide highlights is also how the 1,500 participants will be recruited. So 40 has been allocated for the Northern Cape, 870 for Western Cape, Eastern Cape 340, KwaZulu-Natal 225, and then 25 for the Free State. At the previous meeting at the previous meeting, I think it was in 2021 when we presented the working for programs, we had also engaged the portfolio committee in terms of the interventions that we are going to implement as a means of improving performance when it comes to the branch. So the interventions that we have had to implement do not only talk to the APP, but it's issues that were intended and remain the way in we are implementing or interventions that attempt to, one, improve the capacity of the branch and also establish branch standard operating procedures, but also how we've had to engage other partners in terms of ensuring that the branch is able to deliver on the APT. So this particular slide mainly relates to and is limited to the environmental programs branch. In our last presentation, we highlighted the challenge on contract and program project management that had expressed itself mainly on AG fund findings and other project management inefficiencies in that regard. So with the AG, both internal and external audits, we are implementing the audit action plan, and we are then happy to then confirm that the branch developed standard operating procedures and also in that regard start implementing the standard operating procedures that were developed. On contract and project management training, the DG gave approval for contract and project management training for senior and middle management. This is an area that is particularly key for us because we do recognize that in a number of instances we have very good scientists, but I mean in terms of the challenges that the branch had previously faced, it was then key that we develop capacity in terms of formal capacity in terms of contract and the project management practice. We have fully moved on to the payment for goods and services delivered in this regard and are not in the prepayment system anymore. Previously, on other issues that we had or proposals that we had tabled at that point was that we were going to increase the role and contribution of how we work, particularly with the entities of the department in terms of delivering on the APP. That has been implemented, and as such, I mean, a larger share in terms of the budget and a larger share in terms of the APP deliverables now is able to come through the work and the partnership that we do with entities. We have been exploring and continue to explore partnerships with provincial government and conservation entities. We are currently working with a range of conservation entities across the provinces on different projects of the environmental programs portfolio. But with provincial government, that is where we say, I mean, the conversations are ongoing, but they are not joint projects as yet. However, when it comes to partnerships with local government, we are finding
that we are making progress in terms of our partnership with local government, particularly in the implementation of our municipal cleaning projects, wherein now we have partnered with a range of municipalities across the country to implement these projects. So this slide basically is an update in terms of what we had said previously as interventions, and also then updates you in terms of the progress that we are making in line with the interventions that we have presented. And on that note then, I then move on to the last slide, where I say thank you for the opportunity to update the portfolio committee on the working for programs portfolio. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Honorable members, that is the end of the presentation on working for programs. We'll take Honorable Weber, followed by Honorable C. Honorable Weber?
I'm sorry, I'll take a little bit longer. Thank you, Chair. First of all, I would like to say thank you for this presentation. I think the Working for Programs is an excellent program in general, and I think you guys are doing good work. I have a couple of questions, though. Working for Water is one of my favorites, and ma'am, you've mentioned a couple of things. I would like to know, how do you choose where to go and where to work? How do you identify the spots you go to? The reason I ask for, are you involved with Hartbeespoort Dam and Roodepoort Dam, as they are really struggling with invasive plants? And if you are involved there, I know they have tried the EPWP workers. They work for 2 months, and they're doing it manually, and with the rowing coming up, I'm not sure if they're getting it managed. And then I want to ask, do you make use of the biological agents that the CBC is using? And are you working closely with them on invasive plants? And if, I don't know where to look, it's probably on the website to see where you guys are actually working currently with invasive plants and what kind of invasive plants, if we can have information on that. The wetlands is great. I've followed up on that. I have asked questions on it, and your restoration of wetlands is actually very important. So thank you for that. I want to know, working for Water, how involved are you working closely with the Department of Water Affairs? Because I do know that they sometimes budget for the water things and the invasive plants that we need to get rid of at Roodepoort, and that becomes the struggle between the two departments. So I just want to know if you in yourself work with them. Then my second question is a bit interesting in the sense of you really have created a number of work opportunities. That is great. But when you speak about a work opportunity, is that a permanent opportunity or is it a temporary opportunity? How long does this opportunity last? And I would really like to have information on that, because to me, work opportunity is something that will last because we are in a current unemployment crisis. Then on slide 8, you mentioned that 216 kilometers of coastline cleaned. I really think that is amazing. My question to this is, I found wherever we've cleaned, if you go back a month later, it is just as polluted as it used to be. So do you have a plan in place or a program in place that where you clean, because 2,116 kilometers is quite a long area, if you can call it that. And is there something in place to ensure that the pollution doesn't happen there again? Because otherwise, what is the use of this? So I would like to know of that plan. And then in working for forests, on slide 12, you spoke about the risk of invasions, and I just have one question there. You all know about the shot hole borer beetle, and is it this program's responsibility to try and get
get rid of this beetle because it's really a danger to our forest or even in towns and residential areas. And if it's not, your job is to increase the biodiversity. And one of these things these beetles do is they decrease our biodiversity. So whose responsibility is it? And if it is yours, where are we with it? Thank you very much.
Honorable C, followed by Honorable Winkler.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I think Honorable Weber has really asked the first question, but perhaps I might just paraphrase my question, and that is to ask Kawazela, how do you identify where this project should be located? Who do you work with? Is it with individuals? Is it with NGOs? Is it with government departments? Is it with municipalities to make sure that these programs become a reality? How sustainable are these programs? Because I see they're working for people working all over. They'll cut, do something, and then for 6 months nothing happens. So if you're getting rid of invasive plants, then they grow again. So how sustainable are they? Are they? What stipends are currently being paid, and who monitors and evaluates the efficacy of those workers? Are they doing well? Are they not doing well? Because we hear many times of other programs where people sit under trees, bask in the sun, and the working for programs just become a way of ensuring that we employ people rather than them being monitored. And do you monitor as a department, or do you have management companies, as in other programs, you do have management companies? So that's my first question. The second question would relate to your working for a forest. I think you said 120,000 trees planted and greening. How many of those, if any, have been fruit trees? And will you not consider planting fruit trees because they are a source of some food for the communities where those trees are planted? And do you have trees that you can say to somebody, yes, we can give you 50 trees because Earth Day is coming, and I would like to go and plant some trees somewhere with the local communities? So how does it work? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Singh. Honorable Winkler, followed by Honorable Kancho.
Thank you for the presentation. I have a question under the branch collaboration. I think it's on page 6, environmental program portfolio. There's a program working on waste, and it says to create sustainable livelihoods through recycling of waste, and there's something called the Good Green District Approach, which supports municipalities. Now, I think that ever since I have been on this portfolio and returned, the collaboration between the various spheres of government in trying to provide adequate support to local government level for waste management has always been quite an issue of contention. The separation of source, how landfill sites are being managed, what capacity municipalities are being given, has always been, you know, an issue in terms of what resources are available. So now I see there is something called the Good Green Deeds District Approach. So which municipalities are being worked with? Is this a pilot program? Have there been previous successes that one can measure the success of this program? And how does it also incorporate waste pickers into this sort of like circular waste economy? Considering that there are so many economic opportunities to be gained from, I think, sustainable waste management. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Winkler. Honorable Kanjo.
Thank you, Chairperson, and let me bring the presentation. Chair, on working for water program, can the colleagues be clear on what invasive species are they being managed? Because they are not giving us enough details on this kind of invasive species. There's different, lot of different types of invasive species. Can they be clear on which one are being managed? And on working for forest,
they have mentioned that the program aims to establish or refurbish 3 nurseries, which to me it seems like a low number, very low number, considering the program's overall goals. Can they tell us what is the rationale behind this decision? Why have they decided to choose only 3 nurseries to refurbish? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Kanto. Miss Mkize, if we want to talk about the role of the department with local communities in creating work opportunities, what does number of working for opportunities actually reflect in terms of numbers, in terms of number of days that a person could work? In terms of what is the duration of the employment in days or in weeks, in months, for a person in a year, a full-time equivalent. But what happens beyond the provision of this employment? Do we have cases perhaps where we can say members of these people, these communities who came to these programs as unskilled laborers have evolved into owners, you know, or contractors? What happens to them beyond these working for programs? We are aware that the working for water program, for instance, it's a globally renowned conservation program that was pioneered by Minister Kada Asmal. It then subsumed many of these programs that have since developed their own working on for programs and identities. Since then, have we succeeded to completely eradicate certain invasive alien species? And if yes, how many have we eradicated thus far? But do we also have time frames to deal with the eradication of this invasive alien species? Honorable Winkler, I see your hand. Is that the legacy hand?
Yes, apologies.
No problem. Ma'am Tize?
Thank you, Chair. I will share the responses to the questions with some of my colleagues. I will ask my colleague, Mr. Khan, to talk to just give an overview in terms of how we select areas wherein we will then fund projects, because there is a process wherein we consider various aspects, including threats to our water resources and also other aspects that then relate to the species themselves. And then my colleague, Mayor Matilda Kosana, will then talk to the issues in terms of the duration of employment and also from a policy perspective, what is it that, I mean, from our side, we are then monitored on. For example, Chair, when we report on work opportunities as a department, we do not only report on work opportunities, but we also report on the full-time equivalent. And I'm highlighting this because the full-time equivalent is related to the duration of employment. And then my colleague, Mem Skosana, will then talk to that. And then on the issues that relate to our partnership with the Department of Water and Sanitation, I will talk to that. And then obviously my colleague from forestry will then talk to the forestry matters. So let me start from my side, starting with a question from Honorable Weber. Yes, I can confirm that we work closely with the Department of Water and Sanitation on RWS port and also the Rodeplaat dams. Our approach in terms of managing, for example, the water hyacinth in those areas, it's not only the manual removal of water hyacinth, but we do focus on biological control in that particular area, for example, in RWS port. But we have also been consistent from our side in raising the issue of the impact or the contribution of water quality in terms of the spread of water hyacinth, as an example. and those issues are dealt with, or that particular matter is dealt with by our Department of Water and Sanitation. In terms of the biological control aspect, where we use biological control, we do work with research institutions because, one, we have to check that the agents that are released are doing what they are supposed to do, and also have the control in a manner, or implement the biological control in a manner wherein we do not end up with a situation where we're solving one problem by creating another one. So the biological control agents themselves work closely with the research institutions in that regard. Where we are working currently, we are working across the country. Mr. Khan will talk to that. But I also just want to highlight on your question in terms of the coastline cleaned, that the approach that we are now currently following is a partnership approach where we partner not only with our entities but also partner with municipalities. We have accepted that when it comes to cleaning projects or cleaning operations, it's highly unlikely that one would find themselves in a situation where you clean one off and it's better. So that's why we have prioritized partnerships with the municipalities and also with entities that are closest to those areas. For example, in KZN, we work closely with our entity, Isimangaliso, but also Ezenzelo KZN Wildlife. To Honorable Singh, the question also, because it relates to how we select areas, will be responded to by my colleague, Mr. Khan. And also, just from our side, when one looks at the history of the department, that previously the department would be able to say that from a perspective of work opportunities, we have achieved the work opportunities. But when it comes to the full-time equivalent, that's an area where we've struggled. And that's why, Honorable Singh, as you point out, that in some instances, I think Honorable Gancho as well and the chair indicated that sometimes you'd find that the workers are only active for 6 months or less. One of the areas that we are intensively focusing on is just to make sure that the manner in which we plan our projects and also start implementation on the ground is that as much as possible we start with our participants from the first quarter of the financial year. We've been able to do that with our entities, but where it comes to other implementers, because there are other implications or other contributing factors in that regard, we have not necessarily at this point been able to achieve it, but it's an area that we are focusing in. And when it comes to project management oversight, we use our own staff, wherein we have appointed implementing agents, because our staff has to make sure that the implementing agent are indeed working in the areas that they are supposed to work, and also that the quality of work and any other compliance matters are being attended to, that there's compliance in terms of occupational health and safety, that there's compliance in terms of even the clearing scope of work, the clearing map itself. So wherein we are using our own staff, we also use other staff in terms of just making sure that if it's my project as an example, that there's someone else who then oversees and independently assesses whether my project is achieving its intended outcomes or not. I would like to request that on the question from Honorable Winkler on the Good Green Deal, because that portfolio has a number of aspects, as you said, when it comes to the recycling, the waste issues that relate to recovery, because it straddles two branches, that if it's acceptable, that we can then provide a more comprehensive response, because I can only respond at this point, for example, in terms of the number of opportunities that has been created through clearing projects, and also instance or projects wherein we are assisting municipalities with landfill site management and also training. But when it comes to recycling operations, that is information that I do not have at this point on my end, so we can, if it's permitted, provide a more comprehensive response in that regard. At this point, Chair, may I please hand over to Mr. Khan to deal with the selection of projects, and Ms. Kosana to deal with the issues around or the matter in terms of the duration of employment, and also what then the EPWP or Expanded Public Works Program policy and guidelines dictate to us in that regard. And then the questions raised in terms of forestry will be dealt with by the forestry colleagues, and Mr. Khan will also then respond to the question raised by Honorable Banjo in terms of the number of species that we are controlling through the various working for programs. Thank you, Chair. With your permission, may I hand over to my colleague?
Sure, in that order.
Thank you.
Thank you, DDG, and good afternoon, Chairperson and Honorable Members, DG. With regard to the selection of projects, I'll specifically, I think, speak to the project that deals with invasive species, with the wetland, and specifically the degradation of land. So since the inception, I think, of the Working for Water program back in 1995, thankfully we've been working with the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, the Water Research Commission, the Agricultural Research Council, as kind of, you know, stakeholders in a sense that have to manage invasive species. So there's been a lot of data built up around the location of invasive species and the impact that they have in the landscape. And that essentially now fills out the picture in terms of priorities in the landscape where you want to obviously deal with invasions that pose the most impact. And specifically the filter that we do apply is where it has the predominant major sort of habitat, water impact, as well as biodiversity. And, you know, I'll get to the number of species later on. So that's a sort of a baseline from which we work, that we constantly update in terms of refining those priorities in terms of where it is we need to make investment. The current map I can share with you, what it does reflect is that there's a much larger footprint of demand for sort of degradation in the landscape introduced by invasives and wetlands and degraded land that we need to get to, that we have resources for. But at least it provides us with a basis of indicating where we want to invest, where will we have the most bang for our buck, so to speak, you know, by starting investing, say, at the top of a catchment, because that's where generally if you deal with invasions, you can deal with the light infestations at the top of a catchment before they spread and become a much bigger resource problem to deal with. There's around 80 invasive species that has a major impact that we target, and that's plant species specifically. Of the 771 invasive species overall, there's 80 species that we target, and when we say major, we refer to those species that pose a significant impact on habitat, on native species, and then on hydrological sort of systems as well. And so those are the ones that, you know, I'll be able to share the entire list of 80. But, you know, predominantly you'll find your acacia species, your wattle species, your eucalyptus species, your pine species are the major ones that we generally know of that has the most deleterious impact on water resources. So, as I indicated, that's the how we determine the priorities. Similar with the wetlands, we have a very good idea in the country where the most threatened wetlands are and which are the ones we need to intervene on. Sadly, again, I think more resources is needed to have a much larger footprint in terms of dealing with the demand for that. And similarly with, you know, where you're dealing with land degradation, soil erosion, what we try and do is look at the concept of avoided degradation, invest in areas where there's a potential for soil movement to occur before it becomes a problem and then becomes a significantly more expensive intervention to deal with. But we do have a number of interventions, for example, in the Sitsa catchment and other catchments in the Eastern Cape where we are looking at rehabilitating some of those big dongas that normally feature in a lot of people's pictures when it comes to land degradation. But our priority really to focus on avoided degradation, areas that are susceptible to degradation that rather you manage before it becomes a problem. I think that DDG also referred to, there was a question around the shot-hole borer. Again, I think it's one of the invasive species, but it's a multi-pronged set of stakeholders that have to deal with it. As you rightly say, it will have a major impact on a number of tree species. I know that in the Cape Town area now, the city of Cape Town has taken a whole group of stakeholders in the process. We have participated on that in assisting with the method to control. Still, there's a lot of research needed around potential biocontrol for the beetle, but that's something that we are engaging with a range of stakeholders on. And again, I think the CBC might also feature in that which we are funding a lot of those biocontrol research efforts into some of these invasive species. I think that covers the question the DDG asked me to elucidate on for now. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon, Chair, Deputy Minister, and honourable members and colleagues. In terms of the duration of employment, I think let me firstly start by providing a definition of a work opportunity in the context of expanded public works program, which is any paid work for any duration of time. So as a program, our average duration of employment is about 80 days, and this is due to the fact that we've got programs that have got a shorter duration, such as the cleaning and greening programs, but we've got also programs with a longer employment duration of more than 100 days, like the Working on Fire program. But as a branch, we have taken the initiatives to start looking at longer term employment initiative so that at least we're able to improve on our full-time equivalence. And this is also influenced by the fact that the start of the project becomes very critical. So if we delay in starting the project, it has got an impact in terms of the duration in which the participant can be employed on the program. But we are dealing with those issues as a branch to ensure that at least we've got longer term employment programs in place. And also the fact that currently the minimum wage before October was about 104 rand as per the ministerial determination from the Department of Labor, and the branch has been paying above 104 rand. Our minimum was about 105 rand, and we've got also other programs that are paying 500 rand. And this is also dependent on the nature of the project and the activities and the job-specific functions. I also want to indicate that the Department of Public Works defines full-time equivalent as duration of employment, including that of the training days. So we are the definition is calculated on the basis of 123 days of employment. The other issue that I also want to respond to is in terms of how do we monitor the implementation and the work that is done on the ground by our participant and the supervision. The DDG has spoken to the supervision, but I also want to indicate that we conduct what we call second party verification and assessment, which is independent from the implementing chief directorate, to go and assess what is reported and paid for by the department, the accuracy of the information and the asset and services delivered. We've also, in 2018, completed an evaluation study which was done by the HSRC to look at the environmental, social and economic impact of our program. Since then, from 2019, we then, because of the gaps identified through the evaluation study, we started doing what we call baseline assessment so that at least after a specific period, we can go back and look at whether our projects have made an impact. So we are conducting on an annual basis baseline studies of the initiatives that we are implementing. Further to that, we are conducting what we call data quality assessment audits, where we go on the ground and check the participants that are being paid, their work contracts, their timesheets, and also the goods and also look at compliance to the ministerial determination and the basic conditions of employment. Thank you, Chairperson.
It's the colleagues from forestry to respond to the Working for Forest questions.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Chair, honorable members, Deputy Minister and DG. With regard to the question raised by Honorable Weber on the risk posed by the stem borer, the branch is working with Forestry South Africa in the master plan, and we are co-funding the research in various areas to identify pests and diseases that affect the sector. But because the co-funding came through late towards the end of this financial year, we are likely to know the extent of this risk later on in the year. So for now, we don't know the extent of the stem borrower. There was a question raised by Honorable Singh with regard to the 10 million trees. Chairperson, off the cuff, I don't know how many fruit trees were planted. We can provide the response in writing if we are allowed. And then there was a question by Honorable Gacho, why only refurbish 3 nurseries? Unlike other branches, the forestry branch does not have an allocation. We are funding the Working for Forest from our own goods and services budget, and it is very limited. Honorable members would recall that it is not only the nurseries that we are maintaining. We are also doing the planting in our category B and C's, as well as the silviculture. So we are limited because we do not have the allocation for Working on Forests. But we are hoping, Honorable Chair, that because we are likely to overachieve our targets, we are going to be afforded a wage incentive by the Department of Public Works later on in the year, because you only get the wage incentive based on your performance. Thank you. I think those are the only 3 questions that were raised. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. May I also come in terms of the question that you asked on the, I think it's growth within the Working for programs for the participants? Am I audible, yes. Chair?
Yes, please proceed, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. So in this regard, I would just like to highlight that, I mean, as part of the restructuring or reorganizing the structure of the branch, one of the focus areas that we prioritized and are implementing as part of that structure is creating a directorate that is dedicated to contractor development. Previously, we've as a branch, and also when one looks at the Working for programs, even beyond this department, that the issue of contractor development has been a priority. But in terms of the achievement, when one looks at the data in terms of the growth of various individuals or entities that would have participated, there is growth, but it's limited. And as such, the one area is now in us as a department taking the matter very seriously, creating and dedicating capacity to look into that and be able to then come up with key interventions that then enable our participants, particularly those that are contractors, to then progress through as they participate in the various Working for programs. And in that regard, I mean, this area in terms of the development of our participants, it's an area of collaboration with the Department of Small Business Development. So I just wanted to highlight that there is an area that is key to us. We recognize the shortcomings previously, but we are putting in place measures to make sure that this is an area that we will be able to have a comprehensive approach and make sure that we are able to then monitor accordingly. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. A lot of members, can I check if there are follow-ups? Just on my side, Mem Chize and your team, I think it should be the prerogative of this collective of the portfolio committee to resolve whether the questions are sufficiently responded to, and that there should be further clarification through a written format. I'm raising this because it's becoming a norm. Every other portfolio committee meeting, we get such kind of a response. And I'm not raising it with yourselves only. I'm sending that message out loud there. that it should be this collective that resolves whether these questions are sufficiently responded to, and that there should be further clarification to the questions that are raised by honorable members through the written format. Let's just put that at the back of our heads. Honorable members, are there further clarifications or follow-ups? In the absence of any, we should then thank the team led by the DM and the DG. We are quite happy with the reports that we received. Follow-ups, none. I don't see any. Okay. All right. Okay, colleagues and honorable members, that brings us then to the end of our meeting. I must confess we did extremely well. I just hope we don't... I think we should push like this. We have a better hour to spare. We're supposed to finish at 6 and we finished at 5. Thank you very much to all the attendees. Thank you very much to the Deputy Minister. We have noted the apology of the minister. I just did not speak about it earlier. We have noted it. I think Mr. Leontinis wrote it in the group chat. The apology of the minister is recorded. Thank you very much for attending today's meeting, and the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you,
Chairperson.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Recording stopped.